Hello, welcome to Mosaics, a podcast of the Idaho Office for Refugees. I'm your host, Holly Beach. Today, we get to hear about a country that we haven't explored yet on this podcast and meet a really cool community member whose family is from there. So I'm really excited to introduce Muzdalifa Hamad. She is a licensed pharmacist here in Idaho. Her family is from Sudan, but she spent a lot of her childhood in Libya and then Egypt for a couple years before making the U.S. home when she was about in eighth grade. So it's been a while, and we are so excited to have you here. The reason today that we're choosing to focus on Sudan is because the Pace for Peace in Boise is coming up. This is a really great run for refugees every year that raises money not only for local refugee services, but also tries to have a global perspective and raise awareness and money for a global initiative. So the partnering organization this year, Ataye, is a nonprofit that helps Sudanese refugees. So thank you so much, Muzdalifa, for being here. Welcome to Mosaics.
Thank you for welcoming me.
Yeah, it's been really fun to get to know you. You are a pharmacist, you're in residency, you're teaching. What's that been like for you to be a teacher?
Yeah, so as part of residency, first year residency, I get to teach students, which is something that I did not think I would enjoy, but I actually, after doing it, I really loved it. I get to, or actually got to, because it's over now, but I went to ISU, which is where I graduated from. So it's kind of like a full circle moment. But I went back and taught students second year and third year students, pharmacy students. And it was actually very rewarding, very great. Like, I didn't know I would enjoy it. So it was really good, a good experience.
Yeah, it's so rewarding to have a skill in something and then to get to pass it on to other people.
Yeah.
That's great. And your sister's interning with Pace for Peace. Pace for Peace is a really cool group. They just formed a couple years ago, largely students, university students, and some teachers from around here, and just doing a lot of great work raising awareness. And I have to say, for myself, doing research for this conversation, I was a little bit saddened to think that there's so much about Sudan that I didn't know or haven't learned. I think when it comes across my, you know, Instagram feed, it's always very like dire humanitarian circumstances, which obviously good, like raise awareness. But I'm like, man, I want to know more about the history, culture, different religions, different languages. And that, the more I looked into it, the more I'm like, oh, this is not going to be a half hour Mosaics episode.
Yeah, there's just so much about Sudan that people don't know.
Yeah.
So hopefully, after today's podcast, you walk away with more information rather than just, you know, knowing about a little about Sudan.
Yeah.
So that's my hope of this talk today. So hopefully I'll get to teach everybody what Sudan is and everything else in between.
Yeah. And I know it's like a major topic to just tackle, but if there were something that you would want people to walk away with, what would that be?
Well, let me just introduce Sudan.
Yeah. So
Sudan is just this large country in northeastern Africa, and it used to be one of the largest countries before South Sudan split off in 2011. But one thing that people don't know about Sudan is Sudan's home to hundreds of different tribes, each with its own languages, traditions, feuds, music. And I mean, there's like secondary languages, but then the Arabic is the main shared language. Arabic spread through into Sudan over centuries through like trade routes across North Africa, migration of Arab tribes, and just religious teaching and kind of using Arabic in schools and administration. But Sudan is definitely, it has a lot of native groups or ethnic groups and native languages. But it's just this big, kind of like a more of not like a one single culture, but it's just like a mosaic of different peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So growing up, you were in Libya, but with Sudanese parents. What languages did you speak in the household?
I spoke Arabic. So if you don't know, Arabic is just this language is spoken by North African countries and then Middle Eastern countries as well. But then each country has its own dialect. Mm. I was born and raised in Libya, so I spoke the the Libyan dialect and the Sudanese, because I was surrounded by Sudanese all the time. Like the place that I lived, we had neighbors. All of my neighbors actually were Sudanese. So that is part of how I was still able to keep my like Sudanese dialect. I practiced it with my friends, the traditions and everything else. We kept it, as well as learning about the Libyan traditions and kind of like being, you know, adapting to it as well.
So did you get to go to the mainstream Libyan schools while you were there?
Yeah, I did. I went to school in Libya until I was grade five. Mm-hmm. So, and then the whole conflict started in like 2011 left Libya to Sudan and then to Egypt and then to the U.S. But I did go to the a school in Libya alongside my sisters. So it was really nice to go to the same school with my sisters and friends. And we did not use like transportation, so we would just walk together every day back and forth, and it was a good time.
Do you feel like you were treated well in Libya, like as a refugee family?
Not really. Libya is just this country that my dad himself was not treated as a regular citizen. Mm-hmm. So even though he had a citizen like a passport, he was not treated as one of the people. He worked as a truck driver, and he was not being paid as other Libyans.
Mm, yeah.
And he had we are a big family, so it was really hard for him to support a big family with just what he was earning. And all of us were young, so my mom was just taking care of us, and while he went out to work and, you know, picking up like extra shifts and just doing harder work and to just, you know, earn more money to support the whole family.
Yeah.
But even in schools, there were times where we couldn't go to the same school like the following year. So if one year we would go to this school that is close to us, next year we might not be able to, because they would say, you know, we're called foreigners. Mm-hmm. So they would say, you know, we're not accepting foreigners this year. So then we'd have to go to private schools.
Mm.
Private schools, you have to pay money for it. So not, you know, coming from a family that only the father is working, it's not ideal. There's just not enough money to take all the kids to like private schools.
Yeah.
And it was just a hard life, but it was, my parents described it as better than where they came from. So it was, they're from Darfur in Sudan. So left back in the 80s. They migrated to Libya and they lived there, raised all of us. But they still described it as living better. So imagine, you know, going through all that and it's still considered to be better than where they came from.
Yeah.
So it's just, yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, Darfur was definitely in the headlines a lot during the time when I was in college for the ethnic cleansing that was taking place. And it's awful to know like how many people still, like I was looking up that like of the 50 some million people in Sudan, over 30 million are estimated to need some kind of like humanitarian aid. And I understand that it's because of multiple factors, you know, centuries of colonial rule and the gold that's mm-hmm. present. That's a recipe, I think, in a lot of countries in Africa for the locals to actually bear the brunt of the suffering of what happens. And then here in Idaho, I was looking at the last, you know, 25 years or so, and we have welcomed some Sudanese folks to our state, about 450. So it's definitely a smaller population group, but do you find ways in your family here together to carry on certain like cultural traditions that mean a lot to you? And what does that look like in Idaho, like so far away?
Yeah. We still, I feel like it's not different from Sudan. We still in like weddings or whatever, we would still cook the same food. We still dress the same clothes. So the traditional tobe that Sudanese women wear. my sisters, both my sisters recently had weddings and they wore the red traditional tobe with gold jewelry. Gold is really, it goes hand in hand with Sudan. But we still practice the same things. We still, you know, sing the same songs. We just still cook the same food. It's just, I don't think it's any different. And then we also have a lot of families, Sudanese families that we know here. My friend just had her engagement party a few weeks ago, and we got together, cooked Sudanese food, we played Sudanese music, we danced, and it's just kind of to carry on that, you know, the traditions and everything else. And it's just, it was awesome to see and experience.
Yeah. Congrats to your friends and your sisters for that. It's exciting. You also got some pictures last night on the internet about the dress and just really beautiful, the gold and red and the big nose ring and the chain. And I don't know all the terms for it, but it was very, very gorgeous to see. When you talk about cooking food with your family, is there like one favorite dish that's like your comfort food?
Yes. Kisra.
Kisra?
It's basically this like thin fermented, kind of like bread. I don't know if you know.
Is it like injera? Okay.
Injera.
Oh, yeah. I love it. I got kibrams.
Very similar to it. And then we make this kind of like, what is it called? We can use okra or spinach to make kind of like a stew that you eat it with it. And it's just so good. Also falafel. That's my favorite. Ful mudammas, which is basically just cooked beans. It's kind of like a comfort food for a lot of Sudanese people. And it's also, it was a really cheap kind of dish that everybody can afford and just eat, which just kind of became a comfort food as well. There's something called agashe, which is like chicken pressed down with like very seasoned so much. And people like it. I don't eat meat, but.
Oh, okay. You're like, I need the beans.
My family love it. Yeah.
Is it spicy food, would you say?
A lot of spicy food, but it's just, if you like spicy food, you just add that spice to it. Yeah.
Do you know if there's anywhere around here you can get Sudanese food, or do you have to just make it from home if you want it?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no places to eat here, Sudanese food. There's Ethiopian, but I was trying to convince my mom to open like a restaurant, but she's like, no, it's a lot of work.
It is a lot.
There's no places here.
Okay.
Probably like in Dallas or places where there's more of like Sudanese populations.
Yeah.
Well,
if she ever wants to explore that, we do have the West Bench Farmers Market opening up this summer with a bunch of vendors from around the world who make different foods. And so if she...
Oh, I'll let my mom know.
If she gets that, desire to start cooking, we'd love to talk with her.
Yeah.
And I'd love to try it. It's really fun. I do love Ethiopian food. So just... knowing that at least we can have the injera and similar flavors. But so your family, you know, you said you tried to go. Did you try to go back to Sudan after Libya and then it didn't work out?
We did. So after the whole conflict and, you know, started kind of in Libya in 2011, we were looking for a place to find a safer place. Right. So we went to Sudan. We stayed there for about 3 months. It was really nice and all, but we had to leave. We were not born there, so it kind of felt different. And we tried to, also because, you know, we were born in Libya, so then we did not have, like, things established there, basically. So we ended up we started from scratch. We got our own, we were renting and all, but it was just, there's not a lot of good jobs. We couldn't afford the house anymore. So then we had to leave. We left to Egypt, lived there for about 2 years, 2 years before coming to the US. But it was this long process. It was definitely like great living there. I loved it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Loved it. Like everyone was just so like helpful. The whole community knew, or like the whole neighbors knew that we came from Libya, like escaping the war, and they were so helpful. They would always come ask about us. They bring food if, you know, if they wanted to as well. But it was just so good because we had also we had a family that lived kind of close by. So it was really nice seeing them. And because I've never seen it, you know, any of my relatives growing up. So it was really nice to see my uncles, my aunts as well. And it was just really nice. But then there was just no future for us because there were no jobs that we were, like my sister was working as a radiologist. Mm-hmm. So going to Sudan, she couldn't find any jobs to work the same in like radiology. My other sister was in like laboratory work. She couldn't find anything. So we left to Egypt and then 2 years later came to the U.S. by kind of like a settlement.
Yeah. It must be interesting to go back to your home country, but not ever having been there. What did that feel like?
It was a little different, I'll say. Very little different, but it felt like home.
Yeah, it did.
Everyone is just so nice. Like it was, I think, if I can remember right, I think it was like around Ramadan as well. So the month of like Holy Month, people would be like in the streets eating, the whole community get, you know, come together. You have street cars like parked in the streets. And it was a weird sighting with the cars like just stopping everywhere. And because people would stop people driving and they would just have them come and eat with them. So it's really beautiful to see everyone getting together and eating together. So it was really nice to see. It felt like home, definitely. We adapted, I would say. Mm-hmm. My sisters and I adapted. I got to go to school for a few months, my sisters as well, and they loved it. But it was really nice. I got to see how different the school systems are in Libya and Sudan. Sudan is definitely more strict in that they have greater teaching, I feel like, compared to Libya. Libya, I don't know. It's just less strict. And they're like, I wasn't learning English in Libya, but Sudan, they would teach you English as well.
Okay.
So it was really advanced, I would say, in Sudan. So it was really nice to see the differences between the two like school systems.
So you got to the U.S. around eighth grade. Did you have a good grasp of English at that point to start out
not
with?
Not really.
No.
No, not really. I started out just knowing like a few simple words. There's this teacher. I went to Hillside Junior High.
Yeah.
There was this teacher, Mrs. Ball, and she was just so patient. She, I started eighth grade and it was kind of like an ESL program, but she was so patient. She got to teach us, never, you know, got like upset or anything that we did not speak the language. She was so patient with us. Ninth grade, I left and went to Centennial High School. Then there, it was really nice. I also had teachers that were really interested in like helping us learn the language as well. And then I got to actually see her recently, like when I went to Boise State. I saw her at a kind of like a conference or I don't know, it was like a meeting, and she was there and I got to, you know, say like all my thank yous. And yeah, it was really nice. Yeah. And then I got to actually go back to her class like a few years later and talk to her students.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was me and my other friend that was in the same class. But she was definitely a big part of my success story.
Yeah.
If you call it that. But also at Centennial High School, I had Mrs. Lone. She was also very patient. She was an English teacher. Mm. I actually met her recently as well. I just like to reconnect with people that have helped me in the in the process of me getting to my goal. And I reconnected with her. I saw her that she had like an art show or she was like selling her art.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I got to go and say hi. And she was so proud. She was like, now your name is, you know, you have a doctor in front of your name. And she was so proud. And
Wow.
Yeah, I was just so grateful for her and everyone else being in this, being a part of like this process of my success.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. You got to reconnect.
Yeah.
I have a teacher like that from sixth grade that she would write each student in a journal every day, and then we would write back to her.
Oh.
And then when my dog died, she like really helped me, because we would always write about our dogs together, how much we loved our dogs.
Yeah.
And then mine passed away unexpectedly. Oh, and that teacher, Mrs. Stimson, she just like so much care and love. And like you forget how many students they have over the years, mm-hmm. because they make you feel like you're so special to them.
Like you're the only student.
Oh, it's such a gift. It's just amazing. And not only having that, like I was not going through like a major life transition at the time, but it still was so important to have that loving, caring, patient, like adult figure mm-hmm. in your life to help you get through those times. So that's really cool. You got to reconnect, and they can see that you're a pharmacist now and what you've been doing. Mm-hmm. This graduation season has been really fun, because so many folks that have been like a part of the Refugee Speakers Bureau or this podcast mm-hmm. came to Idaho as children with their families as refugees and are now getting their degrees, like master's in social work or like bachelor's degrees with global studies. And there's several that graduate. So congrats all the graduates this year. It's just really cool to see people embrace the new community that they're in and be like, I'm here and I'm going to make it better for everybody.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I see with this Pace for Peace movement. It's like really embracing the community that we're in and coming together. So I'm excited to have you here so we can all learn a bit more about Sudan together. As we had mentioned, it's not something that we always hear about a lot in the full scope of the country. So yeah, what else would you like to talk about in regards to Sudan?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about how Sudan is divided basically. So in the center of Sudan, you have the capital, which is Khartoum. Mm. And that's basically where the blue and white rivers meet. And then you have...
And those are Nile rivers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
The Nile rivers, yeah. And then you have in the west, there's Darfur, and it has groups like Zagawa, Masalit, Four, Mwindri, like each, you know, tribe has their own languages and traditions. And you have Kordofan, where you have like a mix of communities with like different identities. And then in the east, you have Bija people. Mm-hmm. Then there's Nubians. Nubians are the originals, the OGs. and so their history actually goes back thousands of years. They were actually a big part of the Kingdom of Kush, mm-hmm. which was this powerful ancient civilization along the Nile, where they had kings and they built a lot of pyramids. And actually a fun fact, Sudan has more pyramids than Egypt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it just surprises a lot of people. They're just not popular as the ones in Egypt. But we have other areas like Jebel Moon, which has a lot of farming lands. Jebel Marra has mountains and more farming lands and like waterfalls, and it's super pretty.
Mm.
And then there's also Jebel Amr, which is this volcanic area, kind of like a cave, and it has gold deposits.
Mm.
And as you can imagine, it's been tied to a lot of conflicts.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is just a few places that I mentioned. There's definitely a lot more. But despite the differences in Sudan, people feel really close with each other. Like if somebody's struggling, the whole community would come together and help the person struggling. So it was really cool to see when I went back to Sudan. That was my favorite part.
Do you have a neighborhood here in Idaho where you don't know a lot of your neighbors' names?
Yeah.
That's how mine is. I mean, I could tell you probably like three names, then the rest I don't.
Yeah.
I won't even be able to pick them out in a lineup.
Yeah.
Down the street from me.
It was just our neighbors recently left as well. And then we just keep on getting new neighbors. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I just kind of stopped getting to know them. But I really should kind of pass down what I learned from Sudan.
Yeah.
Which is really this, like, the whole neighbors. Like, you would, if somebody is out of, let's say, like, salt or sugar, you can go to any neighbor and ask mm-hmm. for it, and they would give it to you. So it's so beautiful. everyone is just so close and so supportive. If you have somebody that passed away, the whole neighbor would come and just, yeah, say their condolences and like support you. It's just, yeah, it's amazing to see. I got to see that when I went back.
Yeah. So when your family came to Idaho, what was that like for you guys?
It was different. It was different, definitely different from the other countries I lived in. It took us a while to kind of adapt to everything here, just being, you know, the differences. Halloween was different.
Yeah.
You never see that in the other countries that I lived at. So
what did you see?
Just people dressing up. And I was like, why are they dressing up? Well, like, what's the purpose of Halloween? But also Thanksgiving, it was really different. But like coming from countries that turkeys are not like consumed as here, that was kind of different as well. But yeah, a lot of differences, but we did not let it kind of stop us from like learning about the cultures here, the traditions and all, and we do kind of participate in each of them.
I heard someone else's story that their first Halloween here, like nobody warned them that people would put up like skeleton decorations and spiders and spider webs and like all this spooky stuff.
Yeah.
They didn't really get a heads up. So all of a sudden there's all these like spooky decorations down the street and they're like, what is going on?
Yeah.
So I can imagine that would be quite weird if you're not so expecting that. Yeah. And trick-or-treaters and stuff. Yeah. Do you have any favorite holidays that your family does together from the Sudanese culture or from the Arabic culture?
Eid is a big celebration for us. We have two Eids. We actually have one coming up in like 2 weeks.
Oh.
So you have the holy month of Ramadan, and then after that we have this one big Eid celebration. Then we have the second Eid in like 2-3 months. So Eid, it's always the same, but we would wake up early morning, go pray at the mosque, and then kind of just greet each other. You know, it's Eid. We dress our best clothes. We give money. So it's really nice. Like you get a lot of money from others, mostly to the kids, but yeah. I'm still a kid. So I still get
That's cool.
But it's different here in the U.S. not having a lot of families or people that we know to go to. But in Libya, it was a lot different as well. So the kids would go and like knock on like kind of like Halloween. So people would go knock on doors and you would get instead of candies, or you get candies as well, but you get money as well.
Oh, we need to up our game. That's even better.
We would be like going, knocking, you know, to like people's houses from the morning until like evening. It was really nice as a kid.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah. And then, yeah, you just get together, celebrate, spend the day together. And then the second Eid is when we sacrifice like a goat or something, like sheep. And people would just get together and have a barbecue and, yeah, just spend the day together, chill, kind of dress our best clothes and go out. And it's just, yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah, that's really cool. It would be interesting to go from a country where the whole country kind of like shuts down to observe the same thing, like here we do with Christmas kind of.
Yeah.
To go to a place where you have to be more intentional with your smaller community about making it special.
Yeah.
But that's great that you found your community here to do that with.
Yeah. Thanks.
You said you have family in Sudan still. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And some in Egypt?
Yes.
What's your communication with them like, and what's life like for them right now?
So with all the problems happening now, we try to communicate with them like almost every week, I feel like. It's just because there was a time where we were trying to get a hold of them and there was no signal there. They were in the process of like escaping Sudan. So we had no like news. We did not know like if they were alive or not. A lot of family members just went missing. We had a lot of deaths. It was just really a hard time. So now we try to keep in contact with them very regularly to just see if they need anything. Try to support them in any way we can, because that was just a really hard time for them. Also, like, trying to escape where the conflict is, but then not being able to because, you know, they don't have the money or they couldn't, you know, they can't go. They can't leave somebody behind. And it's just, it was just really stressful.
And also, like, where to go, mm-hmm. you know?
Countries were kicking them out and, like, not letting them cross to their countries. And it was just, imagine, you know, escaping, trying to escape, save your kids and save yourself as well. And people are just rejecting you from going to their countries. And I'm just like, why are we like this?
Yeah,
it was just a really hard time.
Within Sudan, is the danger just general war and violence, or is it because of their faith, ethnicity, language?
It's a lot of things. Let me just explain. So when people think about the war, they think that it's like started in 2023, but it did not start in 2023. A lot of people, especially people from Darfur, know that these conflicts have been happening for years. My parents actually left Sudan or Darfur back in the 80s because there were a lot of conflicts. There was drought. There was just, they were getting killed, people displaced and all. So they left and they left to Libya, but it's still, you know, the people in Darfur still were going through the conflicts and just violence and all. And then early in the 2000s, they decided that they had enough, and they formed these two kind of like opposition groups where they fought against the government. The government at the time was led by the former president, Omar al-Bashir, which then, instead of kind of relying on the army, He supported and armed this powerful, like, militia group. It was known as, like, Janjaweed. And then the Janjaweed just terrorized people, displaced people, killed Darfuris. And they tried to escape to nearby countries, Egypt and Chad, but a lot of them couldn't. So they were just kind of killed in the process. Janjaweed then later became even like more powerful, and then they were known as the RSF, or the Rapid Support Forces, which then you had the Sudanese government, the armed force government, then you had the RSF. So both the people wanted to like have them combined.
Yeah.
But then neither group liked that. So each of the group wanted power. But then they didn't want that. So then there was just this conflict. And in 2023, when the president was removed, the conflict just got even worse. And then the RSF and the armed force government used to like trust them each other. But then they did not want to work together anymore. So then each group just wanted to take control of the whole Sudan. You know, they get access to like the gold mining lands and everything else, but they didn't want to share it. So then each group just wanted to take control. So then the tensions just got worse, and kind of the whole problems just spread to other areas, and the world just became more aware recently because it has spread to more popular countries or cities like Khartoum.
Oh.
It's been happening in Darfur, but it just recently spread to Khartoum and like other areas. Then people became aware of it. There was also like no media coverage. People did not believe that the Darfuris were going through all the conflicts. And they only believed it when it was their turn, and like the people, the violence kind of moved towards their cities. But it's definitely has been happening for decades. But just recently got worse and spread to other areas of Sudan.
Okay. That's a lot to carry, as you know, like your loved ones there, people that you care about. I'm sorry. That's something that people are going through. I wanted to share a little bit about the organization that Pace for Peace will raise money for. And I took some notes here. So once again, this is the May 30th Pace for Peace in Boise. It's in the afternoon. And along with raising money for local refugee efforts, the Atiye Charity Association, they were just founded in 2024, but I was researching what they do, and it's really cool. Refugees in Sudan and then surrounding areas from Sudan, they help with school supplies. They help pay like tuition, exam fees, get food for people, especially during like Eid and Ramadan, making sure people have something to eat during those celebrations. And this one I thought was interesting, access to prosthetic care and rehab for war survivors. So if someone has lost a limb, having access to get a prosthetic limb and rehabilitation. So that's the kind of work that this organization is doing. And so some of the funds from Pace for Peace will go to that. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good work. I know sometimes in the face of things that are, you know, this much suffering, it's like, what can we even do? But sometimes it just takes the little things, like come walk a 5K and meet someone new and learn something new and open up your heart maybe a little bit to a different part of the world that you might not have known much about, like me. I didn't think, I really appreciate you coming and just sharing of your own story. And thank you so much. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that you'd like people to leave with today?
No, I just wanted to thank everyone that's been helping with this whole Pace for Peace movement. It's awesome seeing that people are actually willing to support Sudan. We don't get to be involved in a lot of things that would help our countries. So this was really, I was really excited to be part of this. And I invited as many friends as I can to help as well. So it's awesome seeing how people are really now coming together after, you know, kind of spreading awareness. Because when the whole problem's happening, I felt useless, and I was just, all I could do is just donate or kind of just spread awareness about what's going on. But it was just, that was just it. I couldn't do anything. But now being a part of something, it just feels great. So I wanted to thank everybody that will be coming out. Please bring your family, bring your friends. It's, you know, walking is good for the health, you know. At the same time, you're helping a lot of people going through a lot of things. A lot of them have been displaced to other countries, Egypt, Chad, nearby countries, but then some couldn't even leave. They did not have the money to leave, and it's just... this whole walk is just going to help so many people. So definitely come out and support if you can.
Thank you. Well, Mustalifa, thank you. It's been an honor to meet you. And I'll see you at the race, I think. Yeah.
Yes, I will be there. Thank you.
That'll be great. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for joining the conversation. For more information on how to be involved with refugee resettlement, please visit idahorefugees.org. Mosaics is produced by the Idaho Office for Refugees with grant support from the M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust. Music by the Afrosonics. Production in partnership with SB Studios.